Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of our radically democratic future. I'm speaking with Mary Mohawald. She's professor at University of Chicago, and she's the author of the recently published Genes, Women, and Equality, only her most recent book. It's a book that grew out of work in the Human Genome Project's Ethics, Law, and Society program and grants that she had received to pursue research on the disproportionate impact of the human genome on women. Welcome, Mary.
Good to be here.
So I want to start off with the fact that you, being one of the leading feminist bioethicists in the world, or bioethicists concerned with egalitarianism issues and women in particular, that there are many different flavors of feminism in the world, and there are many different flavors of egalitarian concern in bioethics. Can you just articulate what some of the different strains of feminist concern are and where you fit into that?
Well, I'm glad you're recognizing the fact that feminism is in reality not a singular philosophy or orientation, but it's plural. There are varieties of feminism, and those who subscribe to those varieties may have very different views from one another. There's one thing, though, that they have in common, and that's that they subscribe to some understanding of gender justice. And it's from that perspective that I would argue that, in a sense, the word feminist is not necessary in discussing these issues, because anybody's conception of justice ought to include, as a subset, gender justice, mm-hmm. as it ought to include racial justice, class mm-hmm. justice, etc. Mm-hmm. But so, within even that conception of gender justice, there are some of us who place a greater emphasis on individual autonomy, and others who place a greater emphasis on equality, broadly construed, as including autonomy, but not autonomy mm-hmm. exclusively. Mm-hmm. So maybe we could call one group libertarian feminists and the others egalitarian.
Mm-hmm. And the libertarian feminists are the ones we're most likely to be familiar with, because the battle over abortion rights has been framed as the right to control our own bodies. And
I think that's true.
Mm-hmm. And also, a libertarian strain is what has guided most of Western bioethics, that of all the values, we value autonomy the most and
that's right.
justice the least. Although particular bioethicists tend to be more liberal, but in terms of our social concerns.
No, I agree. I think yeah. that's true.
So in the book Genes, Women, and Equality that you've just published from Oxford University Press, what are the some of the central concerns? So I know that one of them is the way in which sexist society convinces women that infertility is a central deficit in their life, and that you're very concerned about how women who suffer from infertility spend enormous resources and go to enormous pain to have children. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. In a sense, infertility is a different but related area to genetics. It represents a context that I see ought to be educative for us, because infertility treatment in general exposes women to risks and to social pressures on them to undergo treatments that they wouldn't in the past feel pressured to undergo. And with the advent of genetic tests, the proliferation of genetic tests, the great majority of them, if not all of them, being available to women prenatally, then there are possible pressures and increasing pressures on both fertile and infertile women to undergo these tests in order to produce healthy children.
Mm-hmm. And so can you just tell us, so what are some of the pains and the costs that women who undergo infertility treatment, what happens to their bodies during those infertility treatments? How much does it cost, and what's the success rate?
Well, the success rate, by and large, is poor.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's a great range here. We're familiar because of the cases during the past year of multiple gestations. We're familiar with the risk factors involved in ordinary drug treatments for infertility. Mm-hmm. Those cases of the births of the octuplets and the septuplets were situations that were brought about not through any exotic medical technology, but simply through the administration of a fertility drug. A fertility drug that probably wasn't monitored sufficiently in terms of the dosage, and therefore had this risk of multiple gestation. The risk being not simply the multiple, but certain morbidity or impairments that
of the kids.
A largely multiple gestation involves. So that's one factor. In general, infertility is due 40% of the time to a factor within the woman, 40% of the time to a factor within the man, and 20% of the time to a factor present in both or unknown. On the other hand, even when the infertility is due to a male factor, the bulk of the treatment is through the woman's body. And so it's she who undergoes, for example, ovulation stimulation, which is administration of medication that will force the production and the ripening of more ova to be retrieved laparoscopically, to be fertilized with her husband's sperm, which is obtained through masturbation, and then returned to her body for implantation, gestation, and birth. That entire process of medical induction and surgery, even when what precipitates it is, for example, a low sperm count or another infertility problem on the part of a male, is through her body. She's the one who undergoes the risk. So although there is a tendency to discuss infertility treatment in gender-neutral terms, as if couples are infertile and couples undergo that treatment, there is clearly disproportionate risk involved for the partners.
Now, with the Human Genome Project, what we're going to be seeing in the next just very couple of years now, is that we'll have an entire map of the human genome, and we'll be able to, if it's not locked up in the private vaults of the private companies that are trying to patent the human genome, we'll be able to develop therapies and prenatal diagnoses, and women will be able to know sometimes preconceptually if they have if they're in vitro fertilization clinics, and sometimes in the course of their pregnancy, the various predictors of illness in their kids. And you see a great problem and a potential for a disproportionate burden on women in this as well. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, in a sense, I've already alluded to it within the province of genetic testing that's available. The increased today, we can do prenatal testing for late-onset diseases. In other words, for tests that will tell us that a potential child may have a disease in midlife, a cancer, a Huntington's disease. We can know that prenatally already. As the Genome Project concludes, we're just going to know that for any number of diseases, and not only for diseases, but also for certain conditions, propensities, behavioral likelihoods, for example.
Obesity,
all sorts of behaviors. I mean, when I read the literature on behavioral genetics, I was just amazed at the kinds of things, you know, shyness, aggressiveness, intelligence. Now, none of these behaviors, for which there are genetic components, and it's plural, these are clearly multifactorial conditions, none of them, even once we have the Genome Project completed, we've mapped and sequenced all of our human genes, None of these will give us totally definitive predictiveness, because all of these behavioral characteristics and most genetic disorders, as a matter of fact, are multifactorial, which means many genes interacting with each other plus the impact of the environment on those genes. All of those things conspire together so that we can never be, in most of these cases, definitively predictive of what's going to happen, but we can increase the predictability. And to some extent, certainly health providers see that predictability as useful. For example, when we talk about breast cancer, if a woman tests positive for one of the breast cancer mutations that has been identified, we know enough to counsel her to go more often for mammography and to do self-exam, say, mm-hmm. more religiously so that we can mm-hmm. catch the disease.
Avoid risk factors.
Right, and we can actually cure mm-hmm. breast cancer if we catch it early mm-hmm. enough. So there's certainly...
You talk about prophylactic mastectomies in your...
I actually do deal with it briefly. I have a chapter on breast cancer in which I deal with various clinical aspects of it and mm-hmm. prophylaxis. Actually, what genetic tests have shown and what some recent studies have shown is the effectiveness of prophylaxis.
Mm-hmm.
We've only recently got more definitive data mm-hmm. on that. But it depends, of course, on how you define effectiveness,
mm-hmm.
And there certainly are individual women for whom that prophylaxis is not worth it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's another area in which I think social pressures, just a milieu in which a woman, for example, may feel a greater anxiety in the loss of a breast just because society so imposes on her the notion of femininity as tied to her form, to her figure.
Mm-hmm.
That adds suffering to the disease that is in addition to the pain mm-hmm. of the disease itself.
This is one of the real dilemmas for an egalitarian gender justice bioethicist, isn't it? That a lot of the disproportionate burdens are, in a sense, self-accepted or the product of socialization, gendered socialization. You want to just take women and everybody and just slap them around and say, look, don't care about your breasts so much, don't care about the fact that you can't have kids so much. But on the other hand, once we're the products of these socialization, it's not so easy to get away from that.
No, I agree with that. And you and I were talking earlier about what I feel has to be sort of a two-track approach to these issues. While I am critical of these social pressures on women in general, kind of a double standard in many ways, say around the infertility industry, the kind of pressure that makes a woman feel that she's not a complete human being unless she has a child. While I'm very critical of those things, I don't feel that I have any right to hold an individual woman hostage to my political critique.
Mm-hmm.
And so if she can avail herself of medical or societal opportunities for reducing the suffering that society has imposed upon her,
mm-hmm.
then I certainly don't want to interfere with that, even while I try to combat those social pressures and argue that they're wrong and we should try to reduce them right. as much as possible.
Now, another one of the places where that issue comes up is with disability rights, in that a lot of the conditions that disabilities, a lot of the burdens that disabilities impose on people are burdens that in a more perfect society with better support would not be burdens at all and would be part of
right.
the natural variation of human
right.
difference in our society. But given that we have a society in which being fat or being short or other things that are more serious impose burdens on people, we face the situation that a lot of parents are going to want to avoid those burdens for their kids and accept these prenatal diagnoses and
that's
perhaps
right.
undergo abortion or other kinds of therapy. And that's
yeah, and I have, as an egalitarian, I have problems with these issues that I can't entirely resolve. I do believe there's validity in the resistance of the of people with disabilities to prenatal efforts that they see as implying a disparagement of their life, of the value of their lives. And I feel as if the decisions that are made, both prenatally and postnatally, in this regard, have to be recognized and identified as largely socially induced. As a matter of fact, the literature makes it pretty clear that the greatest degree of disadvantage experienced by people with disabilities is socially induced rather than induced by the disability itself. And an egalitarian ethic would argue that we need to introduce social measures that reduce the inequitable impact of the experience of disabilities. The Americans with Disabilities Act that mm-hmm. we passed in this country several years ago was an effort to do just that. It was recognition that we can't make the blind see, We can't make those who are mobility impaired walk, but we can level our curbs. We can provide other means of communication through which the disadvantages experienced by these people who are equally valued to ourselves, if they are equally valued to ourselves, will be reduced. I think that's a basic moral responsibility. It's not something gratuitous. Mm-hmm. It's something that we owe in fairness. You and I are advantaged. Mm-hmm. We didn't earn the fact that we're mobile and have a certain amount of intelligence and affluence even in our lives. It's the luck of the draw. And from those advantages, I think, we incur a certain responsibility to those who don't have them. That's what I believe an egalitarian ethic is about.
But the particular claim of the disability rights advocates vis-a-vis prenatal testing is that when a parent makes a decision to not bring into the world a child with a disability, that it contributes somehow to the burden of all disabled people. And do you buy that?
I think there's some validity in that claim. But it's, again, an argument that I want to make in a way that refrains from judgment about a particular individual. In the chapter on disabilities in my book, I try to propose that the criterion by which a decision to terminate a pregnancy for a fetus that has a disability, that has a positive test for disease or disability, ought not to be the disability itself, but on the honest expectation that this future for this potential child would not be worth it, not the disability itself. Mm-hmm. And if it's true that the greatest part of social advantage of social disadvantages experienced by people with disabilities come from others rather than themselves, then my criterion is not a rejection of this person. Mm-hmm. But it's a rejection of those societal impositions on that person. It's a different kind of judgment. Mm-hmm. At least that's the argument that I make.
Mm-hmm. But you're just arguing that a parent could make exactly the same decision, but that the reason that they make the decision should be
is morally relevant.
That I'm pissed off at this society for forcing me to make this decision.
Yeah. I mean, I think another example of that is certainly a very controversial one. Mm-hmm. I think you have probably different views on it than I, is sex selection.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's interesting. I use that in my chapter on cultural differences and looking at some of the literature comparing cultures, very different reasons invoked in different societies. In the most recent survey on this issue, very broad survey of different countries by Dorothy Wirtz and others, in only three countries, did the majority of medical geneticists, those were the ones that were interviewed, not the public at large, in only three countries did the majority of medical geneticists support sex selection.
Mm-hmm. India, China?
No. India, Hungary, and the U.S. Now, I'm not talking about the populace, and I'm not talking about the government.
And what you mean by support is that they would tell the parents gender of the...
They would agree with, say, doing prenatal diagnosis for sex selection.
Yeah.
Telling them is a different
matter. Parent comes in and says, I want to know the gender of my child.
Because this is the reason I'm undergoing prenatal diagnosis. This is what I want to know. Mm-hmm. Because I will probably abort a female, is what is generally meant. The reasons that are given in those three countries are totally different. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, they illustrate what we discussed earlier about a libertarian ethic versus a more egalitarian ethic. In Hungary, the reason for that affirmation by the majority, and recognize this is three... The majority of the countries, the majority does not support it.
Right.
So we're already in the U.S. are already
highly
in the minority.
Educated and medical.
Right. Yeah. In Hungary, the rationale for supporting it is to reduce the incidence of abortion.
Mm-hmm. Because Eastern European countries heavily relied on abortion throughout.
Because
the period.
Because we would reduce the incidence of abortion if we made it possible for people to do prenatal. Sex selection. And, in other words, abortions may be done because you're fearful of having a child of the other sex. So if you know that it's the sex that you want...
Get rid of half the abortions.
That's right. In India, the rationale is what I would consider egalitarian. It's a decision based on the recognition that the life of a female is going to be tougher. She's not going to be as welcome in society. It's going to tax family
Almost
finances.
Almost a beneficent concern on the part of the physician.
It could be based on a greater concern for other family members, for even for other females in the society.
Or the baby might be killed.
That's right.
Yeah.
So that's what could be broadly considered an egalitarian rationale. In the United States, yes.
The people have a right to know.
People just have a right to choose to do whatever they want. It's a libertarian rationale that's the basis for support. I think that's really interesting that three different countries have totally different
rationales. I'm surprised about China. Was China included in the survey?
China what? I'm not positive. I don't have it in front of me now.
Yeah.
But those were the only three that actually... The majority. But, but remember, we're not talking about the population at large. We're talking about medical geneticists.
Isn't it true that most parents who have a gender preference in the United States, though, want to balance their families, that it's not an overwhelming pro-male bias?
Right. That's why, actually, my chapter on this doesn't come down and say that sex selection is always wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Because I do believe... I guess the criterion that I say is I think it's morally wrong if it's based on sexist reasons.
Mm-hmm.
So then you have to say to me, what's a sexist reason? Well, a sexist reason is a judgment that females are inferior to males. That's a sexist reason. And that is a judgment in some societies or for some individuals. There are people, including feminists, who argue on grounds of what they call sex complementarity and the legitimacy of having of a family desiring to have and implementing a decision to have one boy, one girl type of thing. And I think that's an understandable phenomenon. But I basically argue that so long as the intent, as neither the intent nor the consequences of sex selection is sexist, then it's morally permissible.
Mm-hmm.
Neither the intent nor the consequences.
Mm-hmm.
Because if sex selection were widely practiced, there's hardly any doubt that we'd have a lot more boys in the world than females. And that could be described as a sexist distribution.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can make counter-arguments to that. There are people who would say if we had more boys, then girls would be better appreciated and better regarded. I doubt that that's true.
Higher market value.
And so I think that that's probably still sexist.
Right.
But that would be my criteria. So long as the reason for pursuing sex selection
There are currently 51% females to males in the world. So on strictly gender egalitarian grounds...
But not when you look at the countries in which sex selection is most widely practiced.
Uh-huh.
There we have, as a matter of fact, a shortage.
And that's been true long before abortion was ever available because of differential feeding and infanticide.
That's right.
Yeah. Right. Okay, my final question, Mary. The Human Genome Project has raised the specter for many, including the disability rights advocates that we've talked about, of eugenics. And do you foresee, given that we have a liberal democratic country here and liberal democratic West that's going to be practicing these genetic testing and therapeutic modalities, do you think that that's really a warranted concern? I mean, the way I phrase this with most people is that... most people deciding for their own bodies and their children's bodies are going to choose bodies that are going to be more long-lived, healthier, happier if we have control over our mental faculties. And therefore, we don't have that much to be concerned about. That, yes, it will be eugenic in the sense that the bodies will become, you know, the range of variation of the human body will become less. But the range is going to be increasingly towards a better kind of body. And that is, in fact, the definitions for some people of eugenics. Is that a concern of yours?
Oh, I think it's true that, to some extent, depending upon how you define the term, there's a natural eugenic propensity on the part of parents. I mean, when I was pregnant, I drank milk like I just didn't drink it at other times in my life because I really wanted to make the healthiest kid that I could make. And there's no doubt that that desire has a justifiability and an appropriateness. Perhaps it's a sliding slope, but I think if that propensity moves to the level of saying I'm going to buy a Nobel laureate sperm to make
which is
possibly
happening.
which can certainly happen if I want to do it.
Yeah.
to make the brightest kid that I can possibly have, I think that's going too far along the slippery slope. The reason I think it's too far is because I think it's not only the idea that there is some suggestion of disvaluing the lives of those who are less endowed, less gifted, but also there's a certain sort of cutting off of an openness to diversity here. Here's another point on which you and I might disagree. My very last chapter of the book is on cloning. Actually, I consider human cloning the most conservative step that one can take. I mean, what are you really trying to do? You're trying to take tissue from somebody whose capacities have already been demonstrated and renew that, redo that. Of course, we know that it's not a perfect take, but we're closed to the novelty that normal human copulation entails through the exchange of chromosomes between partners.
You're arguing for what Fletcher called a long time ago the ethics of the throwing the dice. You know, that it's good to accept whatever comes.
You're calling it throwing the dice, and I would prefer to call it an openness to novelty. That openness to novelty has a biologically supportive element because diversity is healthier to a society than conservation of genes.
But we're already severed from being dependent on the diversity of our gene pool for our survival. I mean, we have control now of our gene pool. We will be determining our evolution in the future.
I don't think that's entirely true. I think there's a valid argument that even certain forms of gene therapy, I mean, this is already the case. We are, as a matter of fact, maintaining, I'll use the word for want of another, defective genes through what we can do in terms of interventions. We've, by reducing diversity through measures like cloning, we're cutting off possibilities that we don't know about. You're familiar with the old example of the malarial protection that's embedded in being a sickle cell carrier. I mean, one of the arguments, a conservative argument, granted, against gene therapies and advances in genetics, doing away with deleterious genes is we don't know yet. Possible positive components of some of those supposedly deleterious genes that will be lost if we do away with them. So I don't think developing a genetically homogeneous and supposedly healthy population is societally healthy or even in the long range maximally healthy for individuals. I think genetic diversity is a part of human health.
Well, you've written it a lot more than I have, so I'll defer to your book, which is Genes, Women, and Equality, Oxford University Press, out this year, 1999. I've been speaking with Dr. Mary Mohawald, a professor at the University of Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us, Mary.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS-FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about radical democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. Also check out past and future shows and myriad relevant links at the website, www.changesurfer.com.